The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a story from the personal history section of the November 16, 1998 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Lion and Me, by John Lahr. On November 6, 26 years after The Wizard of Oz was last released, and on the eve of its 60th anniversary, a spiffy, digitally remastered print of the film arrived in 1,800 movie theaters throughout the land. With a rub-rub here and a rub-rub there, The Wizard of Oz, which never looked bad, has been made to look even better. Dorothy's ruby slippers are rubier, Emerald City is greener, Kansas, a rumpled and grainy black-and-white world, has been restored to a buff, sepia, Midwestern blandness. And, since everything that rises nowadays in America ends up in a licensing agreement, new Oz merchandise will shower the planet like manna from hog heaven. The last time I watched The Wizard of Oz, from start to finish, was in 1962, at home, with my family. My father, Bert Lahr, who played the Cowardly Lion, was 67. I was 21. My sister Jane was 19. My mother Mildred, who never disclosed her age, was permanently 39. By then, as a way of getting to know the friendly absence who answered to the name of Dad, I was writing a biography. It was published in 1969 as Notes on a Cowardly Lion, and I used any occasion with him as fieldwork. This was the first time we'd sat down together as a family to watch the film, but not the first time a Lahr had been secretly under surveillance while viewing it. The family album had infrared photographs of Jane and me in the mid-40s. Jane in a pinafore, me in short pants, slumped in a darkened movie house as a part of a row of well-dressed, bug-eyed kids. Jane, who was 5, is scrunched in the back of her seat in a state of high anxiety about the witch's monkey henchman. I'm trying to be a laid-back big brother. My face shows nothing, but my hands are firmly clutching the armrests. Recently, Jane told me that for weeks afterward she'd had nightmares about lions. But what had amazed her most then was the movie's shift from black and white to Technicolor, not the fact that Dad was up on screen in a lion suit. Once, around that time, while waiting up till dawn for my parents to return from a costume party, I heard laughter and then a thud in the hall. I tiptoed out to discover Dad dressed in a skirt and bonnet as Whistler's mother passed out on the floor. That was shocking. Dad dressed as a lion in a show was what he did for a living, and was no big deal. Our small, sunless Fifth Avenue apartment was full of Dad's disguises, which he'd first used on stage and which he now occasionally appeared on TV. The closet contained a woodsman's props, axe, jodhpurs, and boots, a policeman's suit and baton, a New York Giants baseball outfit with cap and cleats. The drawers of an apothecary's cabinet, which served as a wall-length bedroom bureau, held his toupees, starting pistol, monocle, putty noses, and makeup. In the living room, Dad was Louis XV, complete with scepter and periwig, in a huge oil painting made from a poster for Cole Porter's Du Barry Was a Lady, 1939. In the bedroom, he was a grimacing tramp in Richard Avedon's heartbreaking photograph of him praying as Estragon in Waiting for Godot, 1956. Over the decades, the popular memory of these wonderful stage performances has faded. The Cowardly Lion remains the enduring, posthumous monument to Dad's comic genius. While we were growing up, there was not one Oz image or memento of any kind in the apartment. Later, at Sotheby's, Dad acquired a first edition of L. Frank Baum's The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. The film had not yet become a cult. Occasionally, a taxi driver or a passerby would spot Dad in the street and call out, Put 'em up! Put 'em up! Oomph! Dad would smile and tip his tweed cap, but the film's popularity didn't seem to mean as much to him as it did to other people. As we grew older and more curious, Mom had to prod Dad out of his habitual solitude to divulge tidbits of information to us. So, as we assumed our ritual positions around the TV, Mom propped up with bolsters on the bed, Jane sprawled on the floor with our Scotch Terrier, Merlin, me on the chaise lounge, Dad at his desk, the accumulated knowledge we brought to the movie was limited to a few hard-won facts. To wit, Dad had held out for $2,500 a week with a 5-week guarantee, which turned into a 26-week bonanza because of the technical complexities of the production numbers. In the scene where the lion and Dorothy fall asleep in the poppy field and wake to find it snowing, the director, Victor Fleming, had asked for a laugh, and Dad had come up with, "Unusual weather we're having, ain't it?" His makeup took 2 hours a day to apply and was so complicated that he had to have lunch through a straw. He wore football shoulder pads under his 25-pound lion suit, and his tail, which had a fishing line attached to it, was wagged back and forth by a stagehand with a fishing rod who was positioned above him on a catwalk. It was only memories of the Munchkins, a rabble of 124 midgets assembled from around the world, that seemed to delight Dad and bring a shine to his eye. "I remember one day when we were supposed to shoot a scene with the witch's monkeys," he told me. The head of the group was a little man who called himself the Count. He was never sober. When the call came, everybody was looking for the Count. We could not start without him. And then, a little ways off stage, we heard what sounded like a whine coming from the men's room. He went on, "They found the Count. He got plastered during lunch and fell in the latrine and couldn't get himself out." Dad, in his blue sulco bathrobe with the sash tied around his belly, was watching the show from his Victorian mahogany desk, which was positioned strategically at a right angle to the TV. Here, with his back to the room, he sat in a colonial maple chair, the throne from which, with the minutest physical adjustment, he could watch the TV, work his crossword puzzles, and listen to the radio all at the same time. Except to eat, Dad hardly ever moved from this spot. He was almost permanently rooted to the desk, which had a pea-green leatherette top and held a large Funk and Wagnalls dictionary, a magnifying glass, a commemorative bronze medal from President Eisenhower's inauguration, which he'd attended, various scripts, and the radio. On that afternoon, long before Dorothy had gone over the rainbow and into Technicolor, Dad had donned his radio earphones and tuned in to the Giants game. "Bert!" Mom said. "Bert!" But Dad didn't answer. This was typical. At dinner, after he finished eating, Dad would sometimes wander away from the table without so much as a "fare thee well." At Christmas, for which he never bought presents, the memories of his unhappy childhood made the ritual exchange of gifts almost unbearable. So he'd slip back to his desk as soon as possible. Now, just as his ravishing Technicolor performance was about to begin, he'd drifted off again, retreating into that private space. That was irrefutably him up there, disguised in a lion suit, telling us in the semaphore of his outlandishness what he was feeling in the silence of his bedroom. It was confusing, and more disturbing than I realized then, to see Dad so powerful on screen and so paralyzed off it. "Yeah, it's sad, believe me, missy, when you're born to be a sissy without the vim and boive," Dad sang in words so perfectly fitting his own intonation and idiom that it almost seemed he was making them up. In a sense, the song was him. It was written to the specifications of his paradoxical nature by E.Y. Yip Harburg and Harold Arlen, who had already provided him with some of his best material in Life Begins at 8:40 in 1934 and The Show Is On in 1936. I got to the point where I could do him, Arlen told me. And Harburg, who once said that he could say something in Bert's voice that I couldn't with my own, saw social pathos in Dad's clowning. I accepted Bert and wanted him for the part because the role was one of the things The Wizard of Oz stands for. The search for some basic human necessity, he said. Call it anxiety. Call it neurosis. We're in a world we don't understand. When the cowardly lion admits that he lacks courage, everybody's heart is out to him. He must be somebody who embodies all this pathos, sweetness, and yet puts on the comic bravura. He added, Bert had that quality to such a wonderful degree. It was in his face. It was in his talk. It was in himself. When the song began on screen, Dad swiveled around in his chair to watch himself. Once the song was over, he stepped forward and switched over to football. Dad! We cried. Watch it in Jane's room, he said. Is it going to kill you, Bert? Dad's beaky profile turned toward Mom. His face was a fist of irritation. Look, Mildred, I see things, he said. Things I coulda. I'm older now. There's stuff I coulda done better. Mother rolled her eyes toward the ceiling. I returned us to Oz. Dad pulled the headphones up from around his neck and went back to the Hand of Solitaire he'd started. His performance was enough for the world. It wasn't enough for him. On screen, the lion was panic-stricken but fun. His despair was delightful. But I could show my prowess, be a lion, not a mouse, if I only had the knife. The lion had words for what was going on inside him. He asked for help and got it. At home, there were no words or even tears. Just the thick fog of some ontological anxiety, which seemed to have settled permanently around Dad and was palpable, impenetrable. It lifted only occasionally for a few brilliant moments. I do believe in spooks. I do, I do, I do, is the cowardly lion's mantra as the foursome approached the Wicked Witch's Eyrie. In life, Dad was constantly spooked, and his fear took the form of morbid worry. It wasn't so much a state of mind as a continent over which Dad was the bewildered sovereign. On stage, Dad gave his fear a sound. Grang, grang, grang. It was a primitive, hilarious yowping, which seemed to make up, sum up all his wide-eyed loss and confusion. Off stage, there was no defining it. The clinical words wheeled out these days for his symptoms, manic depressive, bipolar, can't convey the sensual, dramatic, almost reverent power of the moroseness that Dad could bring with him into a room, or the crazy joy he could manufacture out of it on stage. It was awful and laughable at the same time. We couldn't fathom it. Instead, we learned to live with it, and to treat him with amused affection. He was our beloved Grump. He was perpetually distracted from others, and despite his ability to tease the last scintilla of laughter from a roll, he had no idea how to brighten his own day. I listened to the audience, and they told me what the joke was. He told me backstage at S.J. Perelman's The Beauty Part in 1962. After he'd got a howl from a line that had no apparent comic payoff. Why couldn't he listen as closely to us? When you kissed Dad on the top of his bald head, it smelled deliciously like the inside of a baseball glove. He didn't turn around. When you talked to him, he didn't always answer. Sometimes he even forgot our names. That was the bittersweet comedy of his self-absorption. But the lion confessed his fears. He looked people in the eye. He was easy to touch. Even Dorothy, in their first fierce encounter, puts a hand on him. He joined arms with the others and skipped off down the yellow brick road. At the finale, their triumph was a triumph of collaboration. In private, as even our little family get-together made apparent, Dad never collaborated. He never reached out. In all the years I went off to camper college, he wrote me only one letter, and it was dictated. He never elaborated on what weighed him down and kept us under wraps. But there was a gentleness to his bewilderment, which made both the audience and the family want to embrace him. His laughter was a comfort to the world. In his world, which was rarely humorous, we comforted him. All the family forces were marshaled to keep Dad's demons at bay and to be happy. An instruction that translated into specific behavior that would generate no worries. Good humor, loyalty, gratitude, obedience, and looking good. If Dad had had a tail, he would have twisted it just as the lions did. Instead, he had to make do with his buttons and with the cellophane from his cigarette packs, which he perpetually rolled between his fingers. What was Dad afraid of? We never knew exactly. Things were mentioned. Work, money, communists, cholesterol, garlic, the big C. Even a fly intruding into his airspace could bring a sudden whirlwind of worry as he tried to stalk the pest with a fly swatter. The SOB has been hit before, he would say, lashing at the fly and missing. Dad's global anxiety seeped into the foundation of our lives, and it was hard to see, and when it was finally identified, it had to be fortified against. One of the most efficient ways to do this was to treat Dad as a metaphor, a sort of work of art, whose extraordinary and articulate performing self was what we took to heart instead of the deflated private person who seemed always at a loss. Any lessons Dad taught about excellence, courage, perseverance, discipline, and integrity, we got from his stage persona. His best self, the one that was fearless, resourceful, and generous, and that told the truth, was what he saved for the public, which included us. Otherwise, as every relative of a star knows, the family had to make do with what was left over. Even at the end of our Oz viewing, Dad brushed aside our praise, which seemed only to increase his anxiety. As he shuffled into the kitchen to get some ice cream, he glanced over at Mom. "If I'd made a hit as a human being, then perhaps I'd be sailing in films now," he said. When The Wizard of Oz opened in New York on August 17, 1939, 15,000 people were lined up outside the Capitol Theater by 8 a.m. Dad's photograph was in the window of a Lindy's across the street, and the Times declared his roar one of the laughingest sounds since the talkies came in. Believe me, it was a tonic for my inferiority complex, which is so readily developed in Hollywood, Dad wrote to Mildred, who would become Mrs. Lahr in 1940. As an animal, in close-up and eight times as large as life, Dad, with his broad, burlesque energy, was acceptable. There was no place for his baggy looks and his clowning, eccentric mannerisms and talking pictures, except on the periphery of romantic stories. Despite his huge success, Metro soon dropped his option. He signed for a Broadway musical, Du Barry Was a Lady. "Well, how many lion parts are there?" Dad said as he departed from Hollywood. Over the years, especially after my son was born in 1976, I'd catch glimpses of Dad as the lion, but perhaps out of some residual loyalty to his bias, I could never sit through the film. The hubbub around the movie irritated me, because the other accomplishments of the performers were swept away in the wake of its unique and spectacular success. I think Dad knew that he was a hostage to technology, a Broadway star whose legend would go largely unrecorded, while, by the luck of a new medium, performers who couldn't get work on Broadway would be preserved and perpetuated in the culture. Nowadays, The general public doesn't know about the likes of Florence Ziegfeld, Abe Burrows, Ethel Merman, B. Lilly, Billy Rose, Walter Winchell, Clifton Webb, and Nancy Walker, whose stories intersected with Dad's. What lives on is the Cowardly Lion. When I watch him now, I don't see just the lion. I see the echoes, the little touches and moves, those long-forgotten sensational stage performances that Dad condensed into his evergreen role. His floppy consonants, slurred vowels, malapropisms, and baritone vibrato all derived from the collection of sophisticated operatic send-ups he developed first for Harburg and Arlen's Things from Life Begins at 8:40 and Song of the Woodman from The Show Is On, to be perfected in If I Were King of the Forest. Each rabbit would show respect to me, the chipmunks genuflect to me. Though my tail would lash, I would show compassion for every underling if I were king, just king. The Cowardly Lion's boxing bravado, I'll fight you both together if you want, I'll fight you with one paw tied behind my back, I'll fight you standing on one foot, I'll fight you with my eyes closed, and his woozy body language, the shoulder rolls, the elbows akimbo, the bobbing head, were grafted onto the lion from Dad's portrayal of the punch-drunk sparring partner, Genk Shiner, in his first Broadway hit, Hold Everything, in 1928. And when the Wizard awards the Cowardly Lion his medal for courage, even Dad's vaudeville act, What's the Idea, 1922-25, came into play. He swaggered like the policeman he had impersonated while trying to both arrest and impress the hoochie-coochie dancer Nellie Bean. Read what my medal says. Courage, the lion says. Ain't it the truth? Ain't it the truth? In later years, one of the many canards that grew up about the film was that there was a feud between the old pros and the young Judy Garland, that they tried to upstage her and push her off the yellow brick road. How could that be, my godfather Jack Haley, who played the Tin Man, told me. When we go off to see the Wizard, we're locked arm in arm, and every shot is a long shot. How can you push someone out of the picture with a long shot? Although Garland wasn't pushed out, her Over the Rainbow, which became the anthem of a generation, was almost cut from the movie three times. According to Dad, Harburg hadn't liked the original tune, which he found too symphonic and heroic. Years later, when I was working on a book about Harburg's lyrics, Arlen explained the deadlock, which Ira Gershwin had finally been called in to arbitrate. I got sick to my stomach, Arlen told me. I knew Ira didn't like ballads. He only liked things with a twinkle. Ira came over, listened, and said, "That's a good melody." I knew the heat was off. Yip tried out a few musical notions and came up with the lyric. Another of their favorite numbers written for Oz was one called The Jitterbug, in which bugs bite the travelers who begin to dance with the trees and flowers. It was cut for reasons of pace and balance, and though it gave Dad a big dance number, he never expressed regret over the loss of the material. What he remembered was the hard work and the off-screen hacking. Smith's Premium Ham, the old pros yelled at one another before takes. Fleming had never experienced guys like us, Dad told me. Some legitimate directors can't imagine anybody thinking about something else when he yells shoot, just going in and playing. He went on, we'd kid around up to the last minute and go on. You could see he got mad and red-faced. Some actors try and get into the mood. They'll put themselves into the character. I never did that. I'm not that, let's say, dedicated. Dad died on December 4th, 1967, the day I finished my book about him. He had never read any part of it. I saw him again in a dream on January 25th, 1977. I'd been arguing about comedy with the distinguished English actor Jonathan Pryce, and had stepped out of his dressing room to cool off, and there was Dad in the corridor. He was wearing his blue jacket with padded shoulders, I wrote in my diary. He smelled of cologne, and he felt soft when I hugged him. I said, "I love you." I can't remember if he answered. But it felt completely real, with all the details of his presence, smell, feel, look, silence, very clear. I woke up sobbing. I added, "When will we meet again?" So far, he has not reappeared in my dreams. But, in another sense, as the reissue of The Wizard of Oz only underscores, he has never really gone away. He's a Christmas ornament, a pin, a watch, a beanbag toy, a bracelet charm, a snow globe, a light sculpture, a bedroom wall decoration. Neiman Marcus's Christmas catalog includes Dad in the Wizard of Oz bedroom, the ultimate child's bedroom, which at $150,000 is more than twice as much as he was paid for the movie. In the space of only 2 days this fall, on the merchandise channel QVC, a new offering of Oz paraphernalia sold about $1.5 million, which seems to prove the claim on the Warner Brothers fact sheet that The Wizard of Oz has universal awareness. I should be outraged by all this, I suppose, since Dad's estate gets no money. I should deplore the trivialization of him as an artist and bemoan the pagan impulse to make household gods of mortal endeavor. When Dad took up painting in his last years, and realized that there was a market for cowardly lion artifacts, even he got the franchise itch, and stopped doing flowers and vegetables in order to churn out lions, which he signed and sold to friends. But, if I'm honest with myself, those tchotchkes comfort me. They are totems of Dad's legacy of joy and of his enduring life in the century's collective imagination. I'm an orphan now. But I'm full of gratitude for the world that made me. I get letters from older readers who knew my parents and who tell me in passing how proud Dad was of Jane and me. It's nice to know. I think Dad loved us. But it was in the nature of his way of loving that the knowledge is not bone deep. So the marketed trinkets work for me like Mexican milagros, talismans that are extensions of prayer and are tacked by the prayerful onto crosses in thanks for the miracle of survival. I'm pushing 60 now. But I find that the conversation with one's parents doesn't end with the grave. I want Dad back to finish the discussion, to answer some questions, to talk theater, to see me now. Almost anywhere in the city these days, I can turn the corner and run into him. I stroll past a novelty store on Lexington Avenue, and there's Dad as a cookie jar. I steal a peek at the computer of a young woman in the public library, and by God, there he is as a desktop image. I go to buy some wrapping paper at the stationery store, and his face stares at me from the greeting card rack. "Hiya, Pop," I find myself saying, and continue on my way. Next, from the book section of the June 7th, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Last Battle Over Big Business, Ralph Nader, General Motors, and What We Get Wrong About Regulation, by Nicholas Lemann. Ralph Nader, now 87 years old, has been a public figure for more than half a century. Many people know him as a long-shot left-wing presidential candidate in four successive elections, from 1996 to 2008, and as the possible spoiler of a Democratic victory in 2000. When he got almost 100,000 votes in Florida, and Al Gore lost the state by 537. Ralph Nader is not going to be welcome anywhere near the corridors, Joe Biden told the Times back then. Nader cost us the election. But his real heyday was in the 1960s and 70s. In 1966, he was a star witness at sensational hearings about automobile safety conducted by Senator Abraham Ribicoff of Connecticut. Nader, a young lawyer who had just published a book titled Unsafe at Any Speed, The Designed-In Dangers of the American Automobile, seemed to know everything about auto safety and to be motivated by a pure moral passion. What helped elevate him from star witness to celebrity, though, was the fact that his principal target, General Motors, hired private investigators to dig up dirt on him. There wasn't any to be found, but Nader caught on and alerted first the Washington Post and then the New Republic. The idea of the country's paradigmatic giant business corporation going after a penniless, idealistic reformer was journalistically irresistible. In the years following the Ribicoff hearings, Nader was able to make himself into far more than an auto safety expert. He sued GM for spying on him and used the proceeds of the resulting settlement to start a series of organizations that investigated what government agency did and failed to do. Nader's parents were immigrants from Lebanon who operated a restaurant in the town of Winsted, Connecticut. But he had Ivy League degrees, Princeton, Harvard Law School, and in those days, becoming a Nader's Raider, as staff members at his organization were known, was a glittering credential, a blaze-wearing way of participating in the culture of the 60s and 70s. A Pete Buttigieg of that generation would have gone to work for Nader instead of McKinsey. In a 2002 biography of Nader that had the subject's cooperation, Justin Martin identifies 1971 as Nader's zenith. That year, by his calculations, the Times published 148 stories about him. The following year, Martin reports, George McGovern offered Nader the Democratic vice presidential nomination, which he turned down. 4 years after that, Jimmy Carter, during his successful presidential campaign, met with Nader twice. Martin credits Nader with influencing around 25 pieces of federal legislation that were passed between 1966 and 73. When Lewis F. Powell, Jr., soon to become a Supreme Court justice, wrote a memo to the Chamber of Commerce titled Attack on American Free Enterprise System, which helped lead to a new network of conservative organizations, he made the source of his alarm clear. Perhaps the single most effective antagonist of American business is Ralph Nader, who, thanks largely to the media, has become a legend in his own time and an idol of millions of Americans. It's hard to think of anyone in American history who has achieved this kind of influence without holding any official position or leading a mass movement. Nader's appeal was enhanced by the fact that he seemed completely indifferent to worldly possessions and creature comforts. He was part prophet, part saint. Legend had it that he lived in a rooming house where he shared a telephone with three other residents, and, of course, he didn't own a car. He was evidently celibate. He was known to work through the night. He wasn't retiring or unambitious exactly. He was a lecture circuit regular, and his activism played out across a vast range of issues. But his selflessness was essential to his mystique. In the 1970s, DuPont Circle, a shabby, genteel neighborhood just past the edge of downtown Washington, was the acropolis of Naderism. It seemed as if everybody there worked for him, worked for an advocacy organization inspired by him, or covered him as a journalist. If you lived there, you'd sometimes see him striding briskly down the street, head lowered, a great wad of papers under his arms, wearing a drab suit and a skinny tie. And feel the validation that came from knowing you were at the center of a consequential movement. Kenneth White's The Sack of Detroit, General Motors and the End of American Enterprise, published by Knopf, presents itself as an account of the decline of the leading automobile manufacturer and, by extension, of the entire American project. But it's really a book about Nader in the first period of his renown. White argues that Nader and the hoopla surrounding the Ribicoff hearings set General Motors on the path that led to its humiliating bankruptcy in 2009. That ascribes a great deal of power to Nader, but White goes further still. The question of why the American economy has stopped providing for working people as well as it once did hovers over politics today. Hence, Joe Biden's and Donald Trump's similarly restorationist campaign slogans, Build Back Better, and Make America Great Again. White has a simple answer. The fault lies with Ralph Nader and everything he stood for. The sack of Detroit is told entirely from General Motors' point of view. It conjures a strain of business-oriented conservatism that seems to have receded, at least publicly, in favor of a preoccupation with the malign influence of elites. In White's account, the big automobile companies, which once occupied roughly the same economic and cultural space that the big five technology companies do today, were almost always entirely admirable. The principal creators of an almost miraculous era of American happiness, prosperity, innovation, and global leadership. Business, in The Sack of Detroit, is generative. Its liberal critics are resentful and destructive. They aim to curtail honestly earned success and to limit people's ability to enjoy their lives. White states that Ribicoff, Nader, and their allies, quote, brought to its knees the greatest industrial enterprise in human history, end quote. White sees in Nader the confluence of two forces that had been building for some years. One was the dissatisfaction of liberal intellectuals, among them John Kenneth Galbraith, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Lewis Mumford, Vance Packard, and C. Wright Mills, with the post-Second World War apotheosis of the industrial corporation. They were troubled by the country's uncritical celebration of materialism and growth, and maybe by the idea of a national culture dominated by business. The other force was less well-known, but more demonstrably connected to Nader, the emergence of the second collision theory of auto safety. In the early days of the automobile, efforts to reduce driving fatalities focused on highway design and driver education, not on the car itself. They aimed at preventing car crashes from taking place. The second collision refers to the way injuries occur when an accident does take place. It's the collision of passengers with the interior of the car. The creators of second collision theory, a Chicago labor lawyer named Harold Katz, who wrote a law review article about it that Nader read, and Hugh DeHaven, a former pilot who co-founded the Automotive Crash Injury Research Project at Cornell, focused on changes in automobile design that could make crashes safer. In 1959, Nader wrote an article about auto safety for The Nation, which led to a correspondence with the future New York Senator, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who had also become interested in the issue. A few years later, Moynihan, who by then was working for the Johnson administration's Department of Labor, got in touch with Nader and wound up giving him an office at the department to pursue his research. White treats the relationships among Nader, Moynihan, and Ribicoff, then a freshman senator looking for a way to propel himself out of obscurity, as an outrage. Nader wasn't a lone crusader. He was a government-enabled compiler of other people's research enlisted by politicians to help them further their personal ambitions. GM and the other American automakers, on the other hand, were blameless. Deeply concerned about safety, he writes, they had formed an industry group to promote it back in 1937, and the annual number of American traffic fatalities had fallen since then. GM and the other manufacturers had already begun offering seatbelts in some of their cars. The constraint on their efforts to build safer cars was that customers didn't want to pay the additional cost. The special target of Nader's crusade, the Chevrolet Corvair, an innovative model developed to help GM ward off the imports that were already starting to compete with Detroit's products, was no less safe than other cars. What distinguished the Corvair was that it had become the target of tort lawyers, ambulance chasers, White calls them, who made a living by encouraging plaintiffs, quote, to collect from others for one's own misfortunes instead of suffering fate in a stalwart fashion, end quote. White could have mentioned that, in 2015, Nader founded the American Museum of Tort Law in his Connecticut hometown, featuring a bright red Corvair on display in the middle of the museum. One direct consequence of the Ribicoff hearings was the creation in 1966 of a new federal agency, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Another was the demise of the Corvair, which GM stopped producing in 1969. An NHTSA report from 2015 estimated that between 1960 and 2012, auto safety measures, most of them government mandated, had saved 613,501 lives, and that the fatality rate per mile of travel fell by 81%, substantially because of safety-enhancing changes in automobile design. The risk of dying in a car crash went down more over this period than the risk of dying prematurely from disease did. But White insists that the auto safety crusade was unnecessary, had little public support, and has produced few useful results. He will not entertain the idea that government is capable of doing something useful rather than simply tearing down what business has built up. Liberals, in his account, are grandstanders, weirdos, or hypocrites. He tells us that Bobby Kennedy sped home from one of the Ribicoff hearings in a Lincoln Continental convertible, not wearing a seatbelt, that Ribicoff, rather than being sincerely interested in auto safety, was merely out for blood and determined to damage the reputation of automakers, and that the prissy Nader found it repulsive that Detroit chose to give muscle cars of the 60s names like Thunderbird, Mustang, Cobra, and Barracuda. By contrast, big business in the book exhibit an odd combination of idealism, a crippling inability to be anything but phlegmatic in public and emotional vulnerability. White surmises that Nader's crusade may have killed Alfred P. Sloan, Jr., GM's retired chairman, who died in 1966 at the age of 90. As for GM executives who were still active, quote, their self-respect and their worldview were shattered, end quote. White concludes his detailed account with the end of the Ribicoff hearings and then covers a great deal of ground with a series of claims that he doesn't go to much trouble to support. One is that the campaign for auto safety wound up destroying General Motors. On the eve of the Ribicoff hearings, White tells us GM was, measured by economic output, quote, the size of Ireland, Hong Kong, South Korea, and Norway combined, end quote. At its personnel peak in 1979, the company had more than 600,000 employees in the U.S., most of whom were hourly workers making an average of around $40 an hour in today's currency. In addition, GM and the other automakers spawned a vast network of ancillary businesses, quote, new and used car dealerships, repair shops, parts and accessory suppliers, automobile insurers, roadside motels, and fast food restaurants, end quote, in White's summary. The company maintained a landscaped suburban research campus designed by Eero Saarinen. Today, GM has about 150,000 employees and currently doesn't rank among the 100 most valuable American companies. For White, this is part of a broader tale of decline. In his view, the United States went from having a mainly unregulated economy to having a heavily regulated one, so much so that the country lost its ability to thrive. White writes, prior to the Ribicoff hearings, regulated industries in the United States represented 7% of gross national product, by 1978, 30%. The regulatory state expanded onto food, cosmetics, credit instruments, packaging and advertising, monopolies and pricing practices, and air and water pollution. Within American culture more broadly, quote, torrents of entrepreneurial energy shifted from producing growth to identifying and combating growth and its consequences, which spelled the end of American enterprise as it was known for the first 200 years of national history. The interaction between Nader and General Motors is sufficiently interesting on its own that one can tolerate the tenacious way White recounts it. But White's sweeping claims about the advent of the regulatory state miss what really happened. The standard explanation for the auto industry's decline, provided by, among others, Nader's childhood friend, David Halberstam, in The Reckoning, 1986, is that Japanese and German competitors began making cars that were higher quality, cheaper, and more fuel efficient than their American counterparts. Other accounts emphasize that GM's spending on wages, pensions, and health care became unsustainably high, owing to a series of generous contracts with the United Auto Workers in the fat post-war years. White gives little or no credence to any of these explanations because he sees GM's decline as being entirely attributable to Nader-inspired regulation. This raises an immediate question. How could safety regulations have destroyed General Motors, but not, say, Toyota and Honda, which also had to comply with the regulations in order to sell cars in the American market? The larger question, though, is what White means by regulation, a term that he never quite defines. The Koch-funded libertarian Cato Institute produces an Economic Freedom of the World Index, and it ranks the United States as the sixth most economically free of 162 countries and territories, far ahead of Japan and Germany. We're bested by a handful of island states. Thomas came across Profits of Regulation, a Pulitzer Prize-winning history from 1984, described the post-Nader period as, quote, a most peculiar spectacle, end quote, in which some types of regulation were advancing and others were retreating. McCraw, no fan of regulation, listed airlines, trucking, railroads, financial markets, and telecommunications as arenas of regulatory retreat. Nader himself was a public supporter of several of these deregulatory efforts. So were such prominent Democrats as Jimmy Carter, who railed against red tape and prided himself on deregulating the airlines, and Ted Kennedy. Later, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama presented themselves as friends of deregulation. The reason that we are now in the early stages of a great debate about regulating the internet is that a quarter century ago, just about everyone, including liberals, assumed that an unregulated internet would be a good idea. So, did Nader usher in an era of regulation or one of deregulation? The puzzle arises because regulation, government telling business what to do, or anyway what not to do, can take many forms. Ralph Nader's larger cause is usually described as consumerism, a movement focused on the welfare of someone who buys a consumer product. Most government regulation has focused on other concerns. The first federal regulatory agency, the Interstate Commerce Commission, created in 1887 and laid to rest in 1995, was intended to put railroads under a degree of government control in order to protect not consumers, but other businesses from being gouged. Ida Tarbell's crusading journalism about Standard Oil, which helped lead to the government's breaking up of the company, was aimed at protecting small oil producers, like her father, not people who bought gasoline or kerosene. During the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt's liberal advisors relentlessly argued over what kind of regulatory state we would have, with the result that we had several. There was regulation to promote competition, to control prices, to prevent the failure of essential businesses, to buttress certain business sectors, to compel businesses to attend to the public interest, to create a stable set of players in one or another industry, and even back then, to protect consumers. Although conservatives constantly accused the New Deal of representing a socialist takeover of the private economy, its authors typically saw themselves as saviors of capitalism. Giving the government greater economic power was a way of fending off the threats posed by fascism and by communism. One common form of government regulation was an agency that would regulate an industry in a manner that represented a sort of brokered peace among the major companies within the industry, the government, and organized labor, which was the New Deal's major supportive interest group. John Kenneth Galbraith's book, American Capitalism, The Concept of Countervailing Power, was published in 1952. It was a celebration of this kind of arrangement as the foundation of a good society. Galbraith had worked as a government price regulator during the Second World War. In 1954, one of Galbraith's mentors, the former New Deal brain truster, Adolph Burrell, proudly announced that, quote, an incomplete list of the areas of American economy presently controlled by the federal government included banking, electric light and power, radio and television, meat products, petroleum, and shipping. Nader's consumerism rejected this type of government regulation. He and his many organizations consistently criticized regulatory agencies that effectively protected existing business arrangements instead of focusing on consumers. When Nader favored deregulation, it was for this reason. He wanted regulators to be fiercely oppositional. After his close associate Joan Claybrook became the head of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration in 1977, the two stopped speaking because Nader felt that she was going too easy on the auto industry. Justin Martin identifies Congress's refusal in 1978 to establish the proposed Consumer Protection Agency as marking the end of Nader's peak period of influence. The campaign to create the agency failed in part because of Nader's purism. Rather than bargaining to create a bill that might pass, he traveled to the districts of congressional liberals who had reservations about his preferred vision and attacked them. During the 1980 presidential campaign, he claimed that there was no real difference between Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. He never again had entree into the White House. Because Galbraith-style countervailing power systems were anathema to Nader, his version of consumerism lacked one of their major strengths, designed-in political support. Compared with other liberal causes, civil rights, feminism, unionism, environmentalism, consumerism did not develop the kind of formal structures that can maintain consistent pressure on government for decades. It was concerned more with finding specific points of attack than with creating large permanent membership organizations, staging big rallies, or generating a cohort of reliably supportive elected officials. Founded on a dislike of conventional interest group politics, it had little taste for the relentless bargaining and deal-making that constitute much of the work of government. Indeed, the intensity of Nader's critique of almost all politicians and government activities created some overlap between consumerism and the resurgent free market conservatism of the 1970s. Nader and Milton Friedman both joined in the crusade against airline regulation, with organized labor and the airlines themselves on the other side. Robert Bork's highly influential attack on antitrust law, The Antitrust Paradox, 1978, proposed that the primary consideration in government regulation of the economy should be the welfare of consumers, as opposed to that of the small business owners, shopkeepers, and farmers who had traditionally propelled the antitrust movement. And it was hard for Nader-era liberals to refute Bork's argument. GM's fall from glory wasn't the story of a new regime of heavier regulation. But consumerist liberalism did tilt the focus of regulation, and the limits of the approach are illustrated by the excesses of tech giants like Amazon, Facebook, and Google. If the only test of a big corporation's behavior is whether it provides consumers with good products, good service, and low prices, rather than how it treats its competitors or what it does with the information it gathers about its customers, the tech giants pass with flying colors. We are now in a moment, for the first time in a half century, in which American politics doesn't rest on a foundational mistrust of big government, a mistrust that Republicans have relentlessly promoted, and that generations of Democrats have acquiesced to, assuring voters that big government isn't what they have in mind. In truth, the size of the federal government hasn't changed appreciably during that time. The New Deal and the Second World War were really the era of big government. And what ensued has been an era of relatively level government, except in dire emergencies like the current pandemic. But then, the idea of out-of-control government expansion was always a proxy for other sentiments, like resentment of the government's limited embrace of the social movements of the 1960s and 70s. The idea that Democratic Party liberalism is centrally devoted to attacking businesses, especially big corporations, also seems like a relic. Republicans are launching antitrust actions and attacking woke corporations, and business sectors like Wall Street and Silicon Valley are either divided in their political loyalties or pro-democratic. In President Biden's early proposals, one can find a number of quite different ideas about what form an enhanced government role in the economy might take. We may see closer scrutiny of the conduct of business, possibly including more stringent rules for financial companies and stricter environmental controls. Concerted support for favored sections like community college, electric car manufacturing, and care work. Measures to strengthen the countervailing power of the union movement or controls on big tech. Any of this would be what Biden likes to call a BFD. None of it would represent a Nader-like crusade on behalf of consumers. There are a multitude of other ways in which the government can try to ameliorate the distrust of the moment and the rising inequality of the past few decades. As was the case during the New Deal, the how arguments will be far more significant than the weather arguments and deserve our close attention. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and will be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments and questions, call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.